How Can We Know? The third talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 17, 2006 at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay. I just want to remind you of what we talked about briefly, remind you of what we talked about last week, why I care about biblical philosophy, and basically what I argued is from... Let me back up. What do I mean by biblical philosophy? When I use the term biblical philosophy, think a biblical philosophy of life. Perhaps. I'm talking about what one understands about reality, about the purpose of reality, the meaning of existence, the way to find fulfillment in human existence, and so on. Whenever we answer those kinds of questions, that could be argued to be a philosophy of life. And the Bible has a very distinctive philosophy of life. That's what we're going to be talking about in these notes. And so the first topic I took up last week was, why do we care about a biblical philosophy of life? And what I argued is that, as you see in your first bulleted note there, biblical philosophy and only biblical philosophy captures the truth about how a human being can find true ultimate fulfillment. And I argued that, as Aristotle himself contends, every philosopher can agree that what we all want as human beings is what he calls eudaimonia, and I've translated that fulfillment. What every human being wants is to be fulfilled. We want our existence to mean something. We want our existence to be substantive. We don't want it to be empty. We don't want to be empty. We want to be something, and we want the fulfillment that comes from that. Different philosophers will answer differently the question, what does it take to be fulfilled as a human being? The ancient Greeks said, if you fulfill your rationality, you will fulfill your being. By being the reasoning creature that you are, knowledge, understanding will fulfill you. That's not altogether wrong, but I argued that from a biblical perspective, that's too one-dimensional, and that the Bible offers a different answer to that. It says that what fulfills us as human beings is what it calls life, and life with a capital L, not just existing, but life as God intended us to experience it and enjoy it, but life as we will never have here and now under the sun. And the message of Ecclesiastes is that here and now under the sun, all is emptiness, all is vanity, all is but breath here under the sun. Evil robs us of the satisfaction of this existence. Death robs us of the longevity of this existence. Just the futility and disappointment of life itself. What our heart longs for, life in this world cannot deliver. It was never intended to deliver, to fill the desires of our hearts. Because this, from a biblical perspective, this world was just created to be a stepping stone to that which we were made for, namely life in the final age, life in the age of ages, what is often translated in the New Testament as eternal life. That's what we were made for, and that's why this existence always strikes us as so shallow and empty and disappointing and futile by comparison to what our heart longs for. Well, so... Why do we care about biblical philosophy? Because if it's true, and I think it is, but if it's true, it's arguing that it's telling us the truth about how the longing of our heart can actually be realized. Not in this age, but in the age to come. And it's giving us an account, it's telling the story of how that's possible. Okay, that's where we started. We got off on another topic that is somewhat actually tangential to that, about what does it take to get that life? Do we believe the gospel, or is there something behind the belief in the gospel? And we'll probably touch on that again before we're done, so I'm not going to revisit that here. I want to talk briefly about the second point under why I care about biblical philosophy. We touched on it, but we didn't really develop it last time. My second point, the bold type there, biblical philosophy is true. It is a truth that is a true truth. I'm borrowing that from Francis Schaeffer. It is a truth that is a true truth. That is, it is objectively true. It says what is in fact so about everything that it addresses. Now, I want to talk about that qualification about everything that it addresses. The Bible is not, even though oftentimes in Bible-believing, conservative Bible-believing culture, we have a tendency to view the Bible as this book that tells us everything that we need to know about everything. I remember once years ago I wrote a series of notes on an ethical issue, whether or not it was ethical to practice artificial insemination by donor. And from a biblical perspective, how should we look at that from a biblical perspective? And somebody who got a hold of those notes, I got a letter from them, a long letter from them. And basically the gist of the letter was, how dare you claim to speak for the Bible about anything that the Bible itself does not address. If the Bible doesn't say anything about artificial insemination by donor, then artificial insemination by donor can't be wrong, essentially, is what the letter was arguing. We have a tendency in Bible-believing Christian culture to think that the Bible answers every possible question that we might have about our life, our existence, our culture, and everything. Or, if the Bible doesn't address it, then it wasn't worth being addressed, and whatever we want to believe is fine. As long as the Bible doesn't address it, as this letter put it, we are free to believe whatever our conscience dictates. Well, the Bible is not the sort of book that was written in order to answer every question about everything. What was striking to me, it wouldn't. I'm not sure I can communicate why it would be striking, because you'd have to read the letter. But the letter writer was a air traffic controller, and I thought, what does the Bible say about air traffic control? I'd like, where are you getting your information about how you do your job? But I can tell that coming out of Christian culture, there's a tendency for us to want to look to the Bible for all the information, the God-given, divinely revealed information about everything about existence and everything about life. It's not what the Bible is. It's not a rule book. It's not a code book. It's not a how-to book. It's not a guidebook. It's a revelation of the truth about what our existence is all about and what God is going to do with it. And it comes in different forms. We'll look at that in the notes that are coming up. So it's only about the issues that the Bible actually addresses that it's true. But when it does address a question or address at issues, it speaks truly. And by speaking truly, we mean it tells it like it is. It says it, what it says is so, is the case. It seems silly to emphasize that, except we live in a time and a place and a culture where it's ingrained in us that there are two different kinds of truth. Religion is true in a different sense in which science is true. Science is true because it's truly true, we believe. It's just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. So science gives us the facts. The Bible gives us truth, but the sort of truth that the Bible gives us is a truth that stops being true when I stop believing it. So that it becomes irrelevant to me the minute I stop practicing it, following it, subscribing to it, acknowledging it. It's just that my religion is meaningful to me because it's mine. It's meaningful to me because I've made it meaningful to me, and in that sense it's true. But it's not true in any other sense. It's not factual. It's not telling us like it is. And I think I hinted at this last week, but what we have to understand is this philosophy of life that the Bible teaches if the Bible is right, it's telling us the one and only way we can get fulfillment as human beings. And my deciding not to believe it doesn't make it go away. It doesn't suddenly become irrelevant or beside the point to me, because my existence is going to become come crashing in on its shoals, whether I like it or not, if the Bible is right. Because it's telling us that what it's saying is truly true. So it just seems almost trivial to have to emphasize that, but in this day and age, it's not the way we think. And so it's crucial that we adjust our thinking to realize the Bible might be wrong. And if the Bible is wrong, okay, then fine. But the claim that the Bible is making is that it's the kind of truth that you ignore at your peril, at your risk. You're risking your entire existence by ignoring it. So I hope that's clear. Okay, let's go on then to the very next section. That's the section I entitled The Bible. My methodology, let me just be personal here, autobiographical here. One thing I learned relatively early in my life as a Christian that has never been shaken for me. I've gone through all kinds of paradigm shifts where I had one understanding of the faith and I realized that's not what the Bible taught, and I shifted to another and thought I had finally arrived, and then that got blown apart and had to shift to another, and that may still happen in my life. But the one constant throughout my whole journey and my whole odyssey as a believer is my conviction that the Bible is my authority for understanding true Christianity. If I want to know this true philosophy of life that it's purporting, I need to go to the Bible to understand that. I call this methodology radical biblicism. My next note there, the perspective in these notes arises out of a methodology that I call radical biblicism. Radical biblicism is the view that the teaching of the Bible, as originally intended by the biblical authors, is the one and only authoritative record of the truth God has revealed to mankind and wants mankind to know. Now, it's not the only source of truth, but it's the only authoritative record of truth. Okay, Jesus came and spoke truth. The prophets of Israel spoke the truth. God has used various means of speaking his truth and revealing his truth to mankind, but the only authoritative record of that we have is the Bible. I guess that's what I say in my note. There are other authorities with respect to God's truth, Jesus, the apostles, the prophets, but the Bible is the only concrete objective record of that truth that exists for us today. Radical biblicism differs from any view that acknowledges another written document as an authoritative interpretation of the Bible. I'll comment on that in a second. That radical biblicism further rejects the notion that one must conform his interpretation of the Bible to the teaching of some non-authoritative written document. It fails to see this as meaningfully different from granting authority to that extra-biblical document. Okay, let me explain what I'm talking about. One of my colleague Ron Julian here has been taking a class online from a seminary in this country. And he took a hermeneutics class. Hermeneutics is the theory of biblical interpretation. He was taking a hermeneutics class where, as Ron would characterize it, and Ron would point out that the professor probably would not accept this characterization of it, but as it boiled down from Ron's perspective, the message that was coming through loud and clear through these lectures is he was talking primarily about a preacher, I think. What a preacher needs to do when he takes the Bible is he needs to look at a text and he needs to study, in this case, the Westminster Confession, the Westminster Confession of Faith. He needs to study and understand the Westminster Confession of Faith and know what it says and know what it means. Then he goes to the biblical text and come up with an interpretation of what he thinks the biblical text means. It mustn't contradict or come into any conflict with the Westminster Confession of Faith. It must say something about Jesus. And as long as it says something about Jesus and does not conflict with the Westminster Confession of Faith, preach it. Now, that's probably oversimplified. It's probably to some extent a caricature. But the point is, I know that Ron is right, that there are whole traditions out there who find their truth in what they would call non-authoritative texts, non-authoritative writings, non-authoritative documents. That is, if you ask them, do you grant authority to that document, they're going to say no. But although they say no, I don't grant authority to that document, but I don't ever go against it either. Well, how does it not have authority? Particularly when it comes to crunch time and you're reading something in the Bible that seems to be saying something different than your creed or your confession or your doctrinal statement or something, and you won't allow yourself, psychologically, emotionally, intellectually, otherwise, you won't allow yourself to call into question your confession or your creed or your doctrinal statement, it sure sounds like it has authority over you to me. I mean, in principle, you may not declare that it has authority, but you're acting like it has authority. You're doing your theology like it has authority. And so part of what I mean by radical biblicism is that you're actually practicing the authority of the Bible and the Bible alone to such an extent there is not a single point of Christian doctrine, there's not a single point of Christian orthodoxy that you are not, in principle at least, willing to throw up in the air and take a look at critically and ask yourself the question, is this actually what the Bible is teaching? Because from where I'm coming from, if it's not actually what the Bible is teaching, then we are mistaken to believe it. Or at least, if it's not actually consistent with what the Bible is teaching, then we're making a mistake to believe it. That's what I mean by radical biblicism. And I believe that that's the methodology that implicitly is being advocated by the Bible itself, I would contend. I don't think anything short of that is really being truly, truly biblical. I can remember once as a very, very young, I'm an intern at a church, and I had been farmed out to another church up the valley here in Oregon one summer as an intern, and I was in charge of the college ministry, and I was teaching the Bible and teaching a book of the Bible for the first time. And it was really exciting to learn new things and discover new things and see new things. And everything I was discovering was probably bunk. I was so inexperienced, and I didn't know what I was doing. But there was one very, very defining moment for me, because I had a weekly meeting with the pastor, and I was with the pastor one morning, and I was talking about some things that I had been discovering in my Bible study. And he listened politely and graciously to me. And then at the end of it, he said, "Well, but if I believe that, I couldn't be a Baptist." And that was a very, very telling moment for me, because I understood what he was saying. I mean, I understood the pressure that he was confronting there. He's paid by Baptist. His whole identity is as a Baptist. His whole self-identity is as a Baptist. His whole social network is as a Baptist. You're calling into question everything, in a sense, everything about who you are, if you actually take a critical stance in relationship to your doctrine. And he's saying that's heavy. I mean, for me to go there where you're going would be a really heavy step for me to take. It was easy for me. I wasn't committed to nobody. I was free and easy, and I could believe whatever I wanted to believe because I didn't have those kinds of commitments. So I was confronted with the realization of how costly it can be to truly be in a position to follow truth wherever it takes you. But it was at that moment that I sort of resolved in my own heart, but how can I do otherwise? I mean, I hope I never get to a point where my other commitments to other people and institutions and my own self-concept and my own self-definition will keep me from pursuing the truth wherever it goes. I pray that day will never happen. Because part of being a student of the Bible and a disciple of Jesus, it seems to me, is to take the only authoritative record of God's revelation that we have and take it seriously and decide that wherever it's leading me, that's where I need to go. Now understand, I know the difficulty of biblical interpretation. Believe me, I do, because I've changed my mind umpteen million times. I mean, I know it's a very, very difficult and complex process. I'm not saying that what I see today is necessarily right and true. It may not be right and true. But what I'm talking about is an orientation of the heart, an orientation of my being, where I am willing to go with what, at least for now, my mind is telling me is true, because it's true, as best I can discern that right now. And that I'm not going to balk at going somewhere, at following what I think to be true, for other reasons, for social reasons, psychological reasons, emotional reasons, or whatever. That's not a good reason to not follow truth. So that I've defined radical biblicism. Now, of course, there are some groups that actually have other documents that they would even claim to be authoritative, and I can't go there. I mean, I'm convinced that the Bible and the Bible alone is purporting of itself that it has that kind of authority. Nothing else has that kind of authority. The next point is just to say it doesn't even have to be a written tradition. Oftentimes it's an unwritten tradition. In the case of this Baptist pastor, I think it was an unwritten tradition that he was responding to. Oftentimes we're not reflective enough to recognize how much we are shaped by the cultures that we're a part of. The language we use, the way we look at the world, the concepts that are meaningful to us, and the concepts we use in trying to understand our lives are given to us by the people we surround ourselves with. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's inevitable. I mean, it can't be otherwise. I mean, we at Gutenberg College here create a community. We create a culture. We create a language. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. We have to be cultural people because it's the way God made us, I think. But the question is whether we are going to be able and willing to have the courage to be critical even of my own culture, which is to say, even of my own self. Do I have the heart commitment to stand even, to be open to criticism even of that? Because I prefer the truth over being comfortable. I mean, some of the most agonizing times in my life have been going through those paradigm shifts in my life, having everything that I thought I believed shaken to the ground, so that I have nothing to stand on, or at least my perception is I have nothing to stand on any longer. I'm not sure if anything's true any longer. And that is not fun. It is a scary, frightening, traumatic experience. But I wouldn't trade those times for anything. Because if it hadn't been for that, I wouldn't have grown. I wouldn't have learned. I wouldn't have come to believe what I believe today. That had to happen. Because having those shaken down, even if you rebuild with the same building blocks, it's not the same building. Because now it's yours. Now it's something you've looked at. It's something you're committed to now. Before, it was something you drank in with your mother's milk in one way or another. And that's all fine and good, and it serves its purpose in human existence, but it's not the end of human existence. It's not the end of knowledge. At the end point of knowledge, it seems to me, is to have knowledge that belongs to you because it's your own. Because you have thought about it, and you've examined it, and you've tested it, and you've studied, and you've learned, and you've looked at more data, and you've decided confidently, this is the truth, and that's why I believe it. Okay, so unwritten tradition can often just be the doctrines that we absorb from the culture that surrounds us. The next point, radical biblicism acknowledges that such written documents or unwritten traditions as others accept as authoritative may be a very valuable resource for the task of biblical interpretation, but it does not grant authority to any of them, neither explicitly nor tacitly. You know, oftentimes someone like me would be criticized as, well, there's all these people who for centuries have believed all this stuff. Who do you think you are to just dismiss and throw on the trash heap of history what has been so meaningful to so many Christians throughout such a long period of time? Well, two things to say about that. Everybody should go back and look at Martin Luther's response to the Emperor Frederick at the Diet of Worms. They charge Martin Luther with being arrogant. They tell him, all these people for all these years have believed this. Who are you to tell them that they were wrong? Everything that people are going to throw at you if you claim to be a radical biblicist, all the charges they're going to throw at you were thrown at Martin Luther. And you know his famous response. You can see him shrugging. Well, I've got a problem. It just seems like what the Bible says is true, and I use my mind to interpret the Bible, and what else am I supposed to do? You can call them wrong if you want. I'm just telling you that this is the truth. This is what the Bible says is true. Here I stand, I can do no other. Unless I am persuaded by the word of God and sound reason, here I stand, I can do no other. Kill me if you have to, but that's where I've got to stand. Martin Luther is practicing radical biblicism at that point. Now, we could talk for a long time about the dynamic that leads hundreds of thousands of millions of people to be wrong over centuries. But that shouldn't surprise us if we accept the biblical perspective on human beings. It shouldn't surprise us that millions of people for centuries could be wrong, right? Because we'll talk about this later, but it's the predilection of the human heart to run away from God, to run away from truth, to find a substitute for truth, to do a bait and switch with the truth of one kind or another. The last thing that the human heart will do naturally and easily is just simply embrace the truth in its impurity and obey it. We're not inclined to do that. So we rationalize and we deceive ourselves and we delude ourselves and we make up stories. You know, we tell ourselves stuff. And in the end, we call ourselves Christians, but we've made up some whole new religion that doesn't even resemble what Jesus and the apostles had in mind. I mean, should that surprise us, given the nature of the human heart, as the Bible itself teaches? So, why was I talking about all that? Oh, yeah. So, there was actually another point I was coming for there. Okay. I'm sorry, I lost it. So maybe it'll come back to me. But radical biblicism acknowledges that such written documents are unwritten traditions that others accept as authoritative. Maybe a very valuable resource for the task of biblical interpretation. Luther was not, and as a radical biblicist, I'm not suggesting that we don't have a lot of things that we can learn from the confessions and the creeds and the theological discussions and conversations and disputes that have happened throughout history. I think I have learned immensely from them, even more than I would ever consciously be able to be aware of. I've learned a lot from them, but I'm not going to exhibit or practice some kind of loyalty to them that keeps me from getting a critical distance on them and ask myself the question, but are they true? Are those creeds, those confessions, those traditions true? Radical biblicism understands that it is a distinct possibility that an extra-biblical tradition, by extra-biblical I mean another tradition other than the Bible itself, will pervert biblical philosophy rather than helpfully supplement it. It might helpfully supplement it, but the odds are just as good, if not better, that it's going to pervert the message of the Bible, not actually clarify it, enlighten it, and supplement it. Because usually an extra-biblical tradition is rooted in a worldview that is that significantly differs from that of the Bible. That's at least a distinct possibility, and that's what I need to be alert to. Most Christian traditions that explicitly affirm the authority of the Bible do not actually practice the sole authority of the Bible. Even those that emphasize its sole authority don't actually put that into practice. I've seen that over and over and over again in my life. I don't know how many times I've been in conversation with Christians who would claim that the Bible is their only authority. We'll go to a biblical text. and we'll look at the biblical text, and through conversations they'll even become persuaded that the interpretation of the text that I'm proposing actually makes sense. Yeah, okay, I can see, yeah, that makes sense. But in the end, they will be resistant to what I'm proposing, and the reason normally comes out something like, I've never heard that before. As if that sort of settles the deal. If nobody in my sphere of influence and my community has ever believed that before, then it's off limits to me. I can't go there. You're not going to make me go there, no matter how persuaded I might be that what you're saying actually makes sense. It'd be one thing if they weren't persuaded that what I was saying makes sense. I mean, then I have no criticism of them. But what's striking to me and what I'm critical of is I can tell that they're persuaded that what I'm saying makes sense from the biblical text, that interpretation of the biblical text makes sense, but they won't go there anyway. Because in the final analysis, the Bible is really not their authority. It's not an issue of what makes sense to think that the Bible is teaching needs to stand in judgment over those concepts, ideas, doctrines, perspectives that I'm comfortable with. I'd rather be comfortable than right is the slogan that needs to be printed on many Christians' t-shirts. And what radical biblicism is advocating is that I'd rather be right than comfortable. And we have to make a decision. You know that's the decision we have to make. Which way do we want to go? The Christian religion can serve people well as something to keep them comfortable up to a point. And that's its function in many, many Christians' lives. And that's fine. If you want to go that direction, that's fine. Except you're not, I would argue, you're not using the Bible the way the Bible actually, for what it purports to be. It purports to be that which stands in judgment over us in order to correct us and instruct us and rebuke us and train us, not something that we use to shore up my security blanket, my comfort. Okay, let me open it up to your... I have more on the Bible, but let's open that up.
I was thinking if you could talk about... There's always been a marriage, a kind of marriage, and maybe it's inevitable, but between violence and truth.
Violence and truth?
Yeah, and just antagonism. I mean, Luther's a good example. But granted, for him, the violence is at the coming this way, but...
Right.
That prophetic spirit really can break division. If it's, and I just wonder if there's how we are to. I'm saying truth is a powerful thing, and you're acknowledging that. I see that. I acknowledge that. In my life, I haven't always wielded it in a good way, and I was just wondering if you could tell us how to wield that critical.
Well, I think there's something woefully inadequate about our grasp of the truth if we could ever use it unlovingly. And I will acknowledge I'm sure that's the case with me, that I have used the truth, if you will, except I'm no longer using the truth. I've used my claim to truth unlovingly at times. But to the extent that I use it unlovingly, I'm not in touch with the truth. I'm not really believing the truth, not the truth of the Bible. Because the truth of the Bible is such where love is absolutely preeminent. It's the God of love we serve. And so any time that I can take his revelation and advance anything other than love in my relationship with someone else, then I am in error even in what I believe or what I claim to believe. But again, it shouldn't surprise us that the claim to truth, it's not the actual possession of truth, but the claim to truth, that would come with violence shouldn't surprise us. Because as human beings, I think, I mean, no one is going to go out in the name of error and fight the infidel in the name of error. I mean, it's always going to be in the name of truth, because there's something in us, just as creatures made in the image of God, that just recognizes truth is the right thing to be on the side of. But the evil in us could care less whether it's actually true, my truth. I mean, that's where the evil enters in. And that same evil that doesn't care whether my truth is true, doesn't care what methods I use to propagate it and all kinds of stuff. So I think it's just a false claim to be in possession of the truth if, to the extent that we violate love in the way that we, as you put it, wield it.
I'm guessing when you were saying, talking about how you changed your mind a gazillion times, I think implied in that is that, not that you get up in the morning thinking, how can I change my mind today? More like what you...
I've been accused of that. but yeah, actually that's not what's happening. No.
More like you have what you've come to, like you were saying, is a hard battle in your mind, but then... But you always hold it with an open.
Let me tell you, some of you have heard this story before, but there, one of the most important tests in my life was a few years ago. I think it was before Gutenberg College started, but it was just the study center. And we had, periodically, we had conferences where we read papers. And I had this paper I really wanted to write because I thought I was really on the verge of understanding the New Testament and faith, what faith was all about. I was on the verge of understanding it, but I just needed to get my thoughts together. And I had a certain definition of the faith that justifies us. But I wanted to vindicate that by going and looking at, take a comprehensive look at the New Testament and the evidence there, and to show that this really was faith. Really what I was trying to do is vindicate the Reformed doctrine of salvation by faith and faith alone. Because I had noticed that you have all kinds of statements in the New Testament, if you don't show mercy, mercy will not be shown to you. Well, if you're not thinking too traditionally about that, it sounds like justification by mercy. Justification by showing mercy, right? And then you have other passages that if you don't love your brother, then you have no life in you. Sounds like justification by loving your brother. And you can go right on down the line. I mean, you have dozens of different things that the New Testament itself says this is the condition that must be met in order for you to get eternal life or be saved or whatever. And they're not always faith. So my hypothesis was somehow all of those other things that the New Testament says must be met in order that you be saved must be logical corollaries, if you understand, of faith. That is, if we really understand faith rightly, we'll understand that naturally, organically, and logically, all these other things are already contained in this concept that we call faith. And that's why we're justified by faith and faith alone, even though the Bible actually gives us half a dozen things that we're saved, or a couple dozen things that we're saved by. You following me? So I was going to write the paper where I wanted to show the logical, organic correlation between faith and all these other conditions that the New Testament made explicit that you must meet in order to be saved. Well, I didn't get too far in that project because I'd been a Bible study for a number of years now, but I had never done a word study on faith. And so I decided, well, this would be a good time to do a word study on faith since I'm going to write this paper. And it blew my world apart. Because faith wasn't what I thought it was. I mean, what the apostles meant by faith was not what I thought it was. Because they kept using language like, believe the message of the gospel. And I had dismissed that years ago. That can't be right. It can't be believing the message of the gospel because, shoot, the demons can do that, right? It's got to be richer. It's got to be deeper than that. And yes, it does. But whatever depth that faith had to it didn't prevent the apostles from just laying it out that starkly and that simply. If the message is proclaimed and you believe it, you will be saved. Well, so I that's something I'd believed in Sunday school years ago, but it hadn't been something that I had believed for many, many years as a Bible teacher. So I had to go back to the drawing board. Okay, I need to sort this out then. What is this gospel that they're talking about? And to make a long story short, that was one of my paradigm shifts. In the process of sorting that out, I came to a radically different understanding of what the apostles were saying and what was going on in the New Testament. And it called into question 10, 15 years of my teaching, maybe. Now, that in of itself is not all that interesting, but what's interesting, I came that close, having persuaded myself from my own study that this was what the Bible was teaching, not what I had taught for the past 15 years. I came that close from going, I'm just going to write the paper that read the paper that supports what I've been teaching for the last 15 years. And by God's grace, I was not able to do that. I just had to face the realities of what I'd just been studied. But I scared myself at how tempted I was to not follow the truth, or what I was persuaded was the truth. Incredible pressure. Because, I mean, it's embarrassing. I've been wrong for the last 15 years. It's kind of embarrassing. What was your question? Why was I saying that? Oh, okay. Yeah, so no. Every one of my paradigm shifts has met a lot of resistance from me. Now, I don't want to change my mind. I don't want to shift my paradigm. But the problem is there's some commitment that got forged in me early on that said, but if the Bible teaches it, Jack, you don't really have a choice. And so that's what's taken me. Yeah.
How did you define the gospel in the midst of that, making it more, I get the impression that you had a richer view of the gospel as you understood more about faith and connection with the gospel,
mm-hmm.
Than just a particular proof text that the gospel is.
Which side of my paradigm shift are you interested in?
This side
of
the okay. How do you enrich the gospel? I imagine.
Okay. Well, kind of the whole all my notes from here on out are going to be about that in many respects. But to answer briefly, what I had taught before is, in order to try to understand the relationship between faith and works in the New Testament, what I had taught before was, I think what the apostles are teaching us is that there's a faith that saves us, but it's not just any old faith. It's a faith in someone. Faith means trust, to start with, on my old paradigm. Faith means trust, and trust is the kind of concept that requires that you specify who it is you're trusting and what you're trusting them for. So when they say that we're justified by trust, they don't mean any old trust. They mean trust in God for, and that was the crucial piece for me, for righteousness, or, and what I meant by righteousness there is for goodness. I'm trusting God to grant me the goodness that I really ought to have and that he would want me to have, and that's the faith that justifies us. What blew my world apart is I couldn't get any biblical evidence, clear, unambiguous evidence, that the apostles ever would have recognized my taking the Greek word pistis, pistuo, to mean trust in the way that they're using it. And what I came to realize is, no, they don't mean trust, they mean believe. They mean having the teaching, the preaching, the proclamation of the gospel confront a person, and the person responds to that by saying, yeah, I think it's true. I really think that's true. That's what they mean by belief. Well, that didn't fit my paradigm. I mean, it was crucial to my paradigm that pistis mean trust. Pistuo mean trust there. So I go back to the drawing board, and what I came to realize is that the whole issue of faith and works is solved in a different way in the worldview of the New Testament. Namely, it's not really the act, it's what we talked about last week. it's not really the act of believing that they're claiming saves us. It's not the act of believing, but it's the heart that believes that saves a person. So whether one actually performs the act of believing that Jesus was raised from the dead and that he died for our sins and the very content of the proclamation, whether or not one actually engages in giving assent to those particular doctrines, that's not as important from the standpoint of the apostles as the fact that I have the heart that is willing to embrace those and willing to acknowledge them. Willing to. So that you can go all the way back to the beginning of time and find people like Enoch or Noah or Abraham whose faith saved them, the author of Hebrews says. Their faith saved them, even though the content of their faith was not the gospel about Jesus. But the apostles are writing in a time where knowledge of the proclamation is not the issue. I mean, in all of Paul's letters, I mean, take something like Romans 10, where he says, unless you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, or the other way around, or whatever it is, you will not be saved. Well, is he making that as a litmus test for every person throughout all of history, throughout all of time, or even throughout our whole world today? Well, not really. He's writing that to readers who know the facts. They know of the resurrection. They know of the historicity of Jesus. I mean, that's not the issue to them. They just flat won't believe it. And so he's saying to them, if you can reject this stuff that you've been confronted with and you know is factual, you can't be saved. I mean, you've got a heart that's rebelling against what God is doing in the world, the truth of what he's up to in the world, so you can't be saved. Would he write that same thing about some lost primitive tribe found in the jungles of the Philippines a few years ago or whatever, who don't even know about Western civilization, let alone Jesus? Would he have written that same verse to them? I don't think so. Because it's a different issue there. Whether or not they believe or not needs to be tested differently because they haven't even been confronted by the facts yet. It would need to be tested in the same way that it was tested in Enoch's case, where that which he does know about his creator, his maker, how has he responded to that, and what has he done with that, and how has he processed that? Yeah.
I've got a question that's a little bit scary to bring up, but concerns the Bible and its authority. And you talked about that earlier, the authority of the Bible, and it is the only authority. Why do you believe the Bible is authoritative, given its history of being compiled by humans and there being potential other texts available at the time to include or dismiss, and we've come together with this whole of 66 books that we call authoritative? Why do you believe that?
Oh, did I skip a whole... Good, Jack. I skipped the whole section answering your question, or partly answering your question. Okay, I'll go back to that. But since you asked, if you look at my notes on page 2, ultimately my answer to that is the second point there. One's commitment to the accepting the truth of Christianity, and you could substitute the authority of the Bible there, and I'd make the same claim. One's commitment to accepting the truth of Christianity or the authority of the Bible, like everything else that one believes to be true, is ultimately multifaceted. Any attempt to articulate it in the form of a single simple proof or argument will always seem inadequate. One of the things that I hope our students at Gutenberg learn over the course of time, a crucial book for me was Michael Polanyi's book, Personal Knowledge. I've mentioned that before to some of you. It's hard to even explain why, but he really expanded my understanding of what human rationality and human intelligence is for me. And his picture of human knowing is we are these little knowledge monsters that have been created. He doesn't use the word monsters, that's mine. But we're these little knowledge monsters who have this drive, this passion to know and understand our world. We just do. Now, he doesn't say this, but I would say that because I think God made us that way. We're created that way. We were created to be able to come into contact with the rest of God's created order, with the rest of reality, and make it our own intellectually, if you will. We're driven to do that, and in the and we have been given certain capabilities and facilities, and built into our intelligence are certain basic assumptions that we have, that from which we can use as a foundation or a platform from which to build. So we try to construct in our own thinking, in our own understanding, an understanding of the world out of the data, the evidence, our experiences, and so on. We take those experiences, we take the information, and we construct an understanding of reality out of that. Well, what went into that? All kinds of stuff. I mean, it's knowledge and understanding, intelligence itself is an incredibly mysterious force in our lives. I mean, hunches, intuitions, creativity, breakthroughs, you know, discovering, you know, any of you who have worked on logic problems or math problems or something, and you go to bed at night and, you know, it's just stewing up there. And you're not aware of doing anything, but out of the blue, all of a sudden, the solution comes to you. Well, where did it come from? You know, well, because there's this mysterious process, this soup going on in your mind that is active on the problem, seeking a solution, seeking to understand that, to know that which is unknown, to understand that which is not yet understood. We can't analyze all the details of where that comes from, how that works, how that operates. It's not a mechanical process. It's an imaginative process. It's a creative process. Just all kinds of stuff goes into it that we can't even understand. We use our imagination, but we don't understand our imagination. So we're confronted with this man, Jesus, who is calling us, who's asking the question, who's raising the question in every one of our lives. I'm claiming to be the Christ sent from God, the Messiah sent from God, with the authority to speak for God himself. And then he did a bunch of stuff to make that plausible. Now, is he what he claims to be? Is he not what he claims to be? Well, that question tests us. And we who believe, who claim to be Christians, we are people who have decided, have concluded, that the evidence suggests he's not lying to me. This is no charlatan. This is no fraud. He really is who he claimed to be. Can I prove it? Well, I don't really need to prove it to you. What I need to know is that operating out of intellectual integrity, I'm convinced that the best conclusion that I can reach, that is the most responsible conclusion that I can reach, is that he really is the Son of God. Do I have to persuade you? Well, no. I mean, that's your business, ultimately. You have to confront the facts. You have to confront the evidence. You have to confront the reality and decide for yourself whether that makes sense to you. But if I have decided for myself that he is, then the next step for me is to look at what was Jesus teaching and his attitude and his practice with respect to this thing we call the Bible. And the reason I'm persuaded of biblical authority is that I'm persuaded that the one who I have declared to be the Messiah, and by declaring him to be the Messiah, I'm basically declaring him to be somebody who knows what he's talking about. That his attitude toward the Bible is that this was a unique record. This was a special, unique, God-supervised record that gives us an authoritative record of God's revelation to mankind. Well, if Jesus believed that of the Bible, who am I to tell him he was wrong when I have already decided that he's the Messiah? In a nutshell, that's the basis upon which I believe it. That's a little bit more complicated, but then you, by looking at Jesus' teaching, what he promised, what he predicted with respect to the apostles, he's predicting a very unique kind of knowledge that the apostles are going to be given by the Spirit of Truth, who's going to be sent by God. And the Spirit of Truth sent by God led them into remembrance of all that he said and did, and into all truth, which I take to be synonymous. Basically, Jesus taught them the whole truth, but they weren't prepared really to receive it. But when the Spirit of Truth comes, Jesus said, he will lead you into remembrance of all that I said and did, and lead you into all truth. Well, again, this is the Messiah promising this to the apostles. They seem to believe that of themselves. They seem to accept the fact that they know what they're talking about based on the same thing, that they have been sealed with the Spirit of Truth and granted the Spirit of Truth. Well, they're the people that wrote the New Testament. So it's on that basis that I grant that. You do have a comment. This isn't conclusive, but you have an interesting comment by Peter, who's talking about the unstable and the untaught who distort the writings of Paul to their own destruction, just as they do the rest of Scripture, Peter says. So there are different ways you could take that, but I'm inclined to think that he's actually classing Paul's writings in the same category as the Old Testament Scriptures. But there's a whole lot of things we could say about that. I mean, it's a big, huge topic.
Yeah.
But at the core of it, I believe in the Bible because Jesus believed in the Bible, essentially. I grant authority to the Bible because Jesus granted authority to the Bible. John 9 was a huge one for me because he makes an argument where he quotes a psalm, and in the end, his you know, basically the deciding factor for him was, he says parenthetically, the Scripture says, and the Scripture cannot be broken. Well, now, what complicates that, though, is, but maybe Jesus didn't really believe that. Maybe people made that up and, you know, wrote the Gospels later and just wrote it as if he believed all that. Okay, that's possible. It's logically possible. How do I test that? Well, that's where other facets of the truth of this, other evidence comes in. And one of the big ones for me is, if I just give the Bible enough of a break to hear it out, you know, what are you teaching me? What are you saying? What are you saying the world is like? What are you saying God is like? What are you saying I am like? And so on. It is, in a sense, self-attesting in my mind. And what I mean by that, I don't mean by that the same thing some people would mean by that. What I mean by that is things that I can evaluate about myself, namely that I'm a sinner, from my own experience and from the evidence of my own life. It really seems to, it knew me before I did. It knew me better than I do myself. And as I read the Scriptures, I'm laid bare by them. Well, why? Why did it get that so right? One possible explanation is because it is what it says it is. It's the authoritative Word of God. But again, that's not my argument. You know, those are just suggestive sorts of things that I can drudge up about the kinds of things that have been compelling to me. But I don't even know all the things that have been compelling to me, because some of them are very, what Polanyi calls tacit. They're unconscious, they're subconscious. But that's just because that's the way rationality works. None of us know why we believe what we believe, everything about why we believe what we believe. It just makes sense to us. But rationality is not infallible. That's why we have to keep adjusting and correcting and learning. And that's the wonderful thing about rationality, is it's self-correcting. When it gets it wrong, it can figure out that it got it wrong and take steps to fix it. Okay, I'm sorry. Anything else on the Bible? Yeah.
I'm curious about Jesus saying, you'll remember everything. the Spirit will help you remember everything, then we know all truth. Is it possible that the leading means recollection is one, interpretation is another?
Mm-hmm.
Is the leading of the all truth there the same type of leading under truth that is the openness of the Spirit that we all have?
No, I don't think so. I think the promise that he's making there is unique to the what we call the apostles, and that the leading into all truth. I take those together. I don't think he's saying he's going to lead you to remember and recall everything that I said and did, and he's going to lead you into all truth. I think it's the interpretation of what he said and did that is a true understanding of what he meant, what God intended to reveal. That's what the Spirit of Truth is going to lead them into. And in my understanding of what Jesus is saying there, the only reason they would know that it's the Spirit of Truth leading them into that is because Jesus tells them that. I mean, at the level of their own experience, I think they would experience it as remembering and understanding. You see what I'm saying? I mean, I don't think there's anything... What's supernatural about it is God working back behind the scenes to lead these particular people into getting it right, because we can get it wrong. But he was going to lead them into getting it right. But the way they experienced coming to understand the gospel was remembering what Jesus taught them in the light of what he did and what happened to him and so on, and getting the hunch that said, oh, this is what he was talking about, and this is what he meant, and this is how it is, and this is what's true.
I suppose my question is kind of maybe a little speculative, but it's, was that process one of development? Like, was that the same sort of process that we have, that it is kind of intermingled with, you know, kind of going, well, that's not right.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in a way you see it, because in Galatians, where Paul describes his confrontation with Peter at Antioch, Peter's development was not quite as far along as Paul's with respect to understanding the implications of the gospel for the Gentiles.
That was a scripture behind my question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Any other comments on that?
Yeah. You were talking about how we often want to just be comforted by the Bible
or religion.
It reminded me of recently I was with a good friend of mine, and we were walking, and it was a Sunday morning, and I said, what are you going to do today? And she said, well, I like to watch this television feature. But she was anxious that I not watch it with her, because she thought that I would be too critical. And she said, I don't really care if he's really accurate, but he really is encouraging. It's me. Feel positive. And I just said, it's fine, and I didn't want to be judgmental or critical at that moment. But I really do believe that she is someone who has responded to the gospel message positively, that she's a true believer, and yet it just seems so contrary somehow that she would want to hear just something encouraging, whether it was accurate or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered, what do you think of that kind of attitude? Or can you be a real believer and just be mistaken about that? Or is it more fundamental?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, being a believer is just incredibly messy. I mean, if I look at my own life, I'm embarrassed by some of the things I used to believe. And one day, maybe I'll be embarrassed by some of the things I believe and am saying today. I mean, that's entirely possible, because we grow and we learn and we develop. In the meantime, I may very well be on track. The Spirit of God may have me by the collar, dragging me toward the truth, but I don't understand any of it. And I say foolish things, and I do foolish things, and I think foolish things, and I feel foolish things, and all that stuff is going on. But we're really believers. Having said that, that sentiment, I think, is ultimately dangerous. I mean, it's something we need to grow out of, because if we as a whole community and as a whole culture can take the attitude, it really doesn't matter whether it's true. All that matters is whether it ministers to me or blesses me or whatever. Then we might as well not have a Bible. I mean, there's no standard to be a check on that. I mean, I would argue that that's probably the state of most of our churches in America today, is the people who are going to the churches don't want to be taught. They don't want to be instructed. They want to be blessed equals entertained or whatever. I mean, they want to somehow have some kind of psychological, emotional reward that comes out of the worship service or the sermon or the message or whatever. But they're looking for an emotional and psychological reward. They're not looking for truth. So they don't hold the pastor accountable. He doesn't have to give them truth, and he can be rewarded socially for doing a good job and giving a good sermon and all that kind of stuff without ever having touched the truth, because that's not what they're looking for anyway. And so it becomes this kind of a symbiotic relationship where the pastor's not encouraged to seek and teach the truth, and if he were, he wouldn't get rewarded for it anyway. I mean, they don't want it. So they're getting what they want, and he's getting what he wants, and nobody's doing business with the truth at all. Unfortunately, I think there are far too many churches where that's the case. So ultimately, it's dangerous, but I wouldn't judge any individual in particular.
That's right. His first comment about it being powerful and potentially bringing the violence, but like animosity, perhaps. If I were to say something, I mean, that was my thought exactly. It was like, well, it's great to be encouraged, but it has to, if it's not true, it hasn't been worth anything. Mm-hmm. But for me to say that would sort of all of a sudden introduce this animosity, or like then she would have to defend herself or something like that. And mm-hmm. I wasn't sure how to deal with that or how to relate to that.
Well, all of us need to recognize how prone we are to make up stories that we tell ourselves, because the lie encourages us. A false hope, but a hope. A false security, but a security. But the problem is building your house on unstable ground. I mean, if it's not true, then your security is worthless and your hope is ridiculous, because a false hope is no hope at all. And a false security is no security at all. So wouldn't we rather build our house on solid rock? I mean, on something that's not going to be shaken by the reality of how it really is? So we do need to be aware of that. I mean, whenever people offer as the justification for them they're liking a message or liking a doctrine or something, simply that, well, it makes me feel good, or it encourages me, or it blesses me, or something like that, we need to recognize what a shallow criteria that is. Because unbelievers are always encouraged by the lies they tell themselves. So what does that prove?
Jack, if I agree with you that the Bible is the only authoritative record of truth, what do I do about all the English translations that are
You have to know that they are not an authoritative record of the truth. For me, in my mind, the authoritative record of the truth is what was actually penned by the apostle or his secretary, whichever put pen to ink, what was actually written in the language in which they wrote it. And our translations are an attempt to translate that into English, but I'm not prepared to say that any translator or any translation is authoritative and necessarily got it right. That's why learning Greek is a good thing.
I was thinking about your friend, and I just want to say that I don't know how far you went into this with her, but it's totally possible that when she said it's not accurate, I don't know if she's been around the study center or like what she meant by that, but it could be that she meant like maybe he's not very good at interpreting the Bible or something like that, but maybe he's using one scripture that has nothing to do with loving your neighbor, but he's saying love your neighbor and that kind of thing. He's speaking the truth, but not doing a very good job of it. It could be that she was really encouraged, even though it was truth, but he wasn't very smart about it. Like, you, I just would think you would want to leave room for that possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. Yeah, that there are a lot of people who may not be very sophisticated in their exegesis, but who are very wise and who understand that truth that the Bible is teaching and can present that in a way that's very compelling and moving to people, and people respond to it, and that's fine. That's great. I mean, ultimately,
right.
I think we're all better off if we do good exegesis, but in the meantime... Right.
And not wanting to be judged. I guess I could see that really easily. If someone feels like, well, maybe they're not really as smart as they could be, but I sure feel like they're speaking to my heart, because essentially the message is the same as what the gospel is preaching. And that's completely valid, and I
sure.
think there's, you know, you have to respect that.
Yeah, thanks. That's a good point. Very good point.
I'm wrestling with my church history, but there's a couple hundred years at least, I think, that goes by before the established canons of the New Testament. Do you have any comment on that? I mean, it's messy. It would be nice if they said, okay, as soon as Peter wrote his letters, or Paul, or Matthew, they said, okay, now this is that part that Jesus reminded us of, and was saying the Spirit of Truth would lead us into. But it didn't come down that way.
Or if Jesus would have said, here, this is the New Testament.
Yeah.
You know, then it's like, oh, well, Jesus said it was, so we're good.
Yeah, so can you
Here's
comment...
the New Testament for
$9.99. Yeah. So could you comment on the process of how we got that? It kind of is going along with this question, I think. And that's a big part of it, the process.
Yeah. What was the council where they set the New Testament?
Nicaea? 320 or something?
Okay. The picture that you often get is that we don't really have a Bible until that council. I don't think that's a right way to understand history. I think the canon was shaped and formed and established under the eyesight of the apostles themselves in the first generation church. Everybody knew what the canon was. You don't have the church establishing a canon until it begins to be the case that not everyone knows any longer. Well, and it's not even so much remember, but you have heretics coming along who are actually challenging the canon and who are saying, yeah, well, you guys think this is the canon, but it really isn't. Well, now, just like the Gospels were written, I think Luke basically says this in the opening of Luke. He writes it because he recognizes these facts aren't always going to be known. We can't just trust this to hearsay. We have to write this down so that the future generations can know that this is what went down. This is who Jesus was. This is what he did. This is what he said. The same thing happened with the canon. As long as everyone informally knows what it is, you don't have a problem. But then when controversy arises about what the canon is, now all of a sudden you need something to put it in historical concrete, if you will. And that's what they felt the need to do at the Council of Nicaea. So the question... Sorry? Yeah, and there were other books that people were contending ought to be included. So oftentimes the Council of Nicaea gets presented by critics of Christianity as if what was being decided there is what do we want in our Bible, which is a bizarre, I mean, that would be totally bizarre. What we want, I want James. No, I don't want James. I want Peter. I don't want Peter. But I think it makes just a whole lot more sense that the question that they were posing for themselves is, what is the canon that was established in the first generation church? It's a historical question. What was the true canon that we have always accepted throughout all these years? And the answer we get is the Council of Nicaea. Is that authoritative? No, it's not, I don't think. I'm open to the possibility, if someone can make the case, that there's a book of the Bible that really doesn't belong there. I'm open to considering that because I don't have any authoritative statement about what the canon is. At this point, I think I've worked with the New Testament enough to think that I'm probably not going to be persuaded by any arguments because I'm pretty much persuaded that they are speaking with one voice and presenting the same message and with a unity that is striking. So I think the New Testament canon is what it ought to be.
Would there be that same openness to then maybe a somehow lost scroll that would be considered?
Sure. In principle, I'm open to that. Sure. But I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah. Or the other way, to a book thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
That was when I was after in the park.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, a lot of our conservatism as Christians, where, no, this is the Bible, and don't you challenge it, and don't you be critical of it, and don't you even suggest that it might be wrong. Our conservatism comes out of fear. We're just afraid that maybe I've got it wrong, so don't you even raise the question about that. We of all people need not fear. I mean, the truth is the truth, and the truth will win out in the end. Unless I'm in rebellion against the truth is going to compel me. It's going to be persuasive to me. And so instead of being afraid of that process, I think ultimately we of all people are the people who are in a position to believe we can be open to that process. So a Bible-believing Christian is not conservative per se. He's just serious about the truth. And they're not always the same thing. I'll let you go. Sorry I skipped the the topic, but we'll take that up next time. Good.